fake it?
No. No, I'm quite candid. I'm sure you got over it somehow.
If you're very tired and would really just prefer to have a nap, you know, just send me away.
No, I napped in the bus coming here. That's no good. However, I'm prepared for anything. You have lists of questions.
Oh, I have lists of questions. I feel like a dentist.
No, I like it. I like concrete questions.
Here's a concrete question. Yeah. They're in no order, I might. You're going to be in a...
Go on.
It's going to put you under severe neurological strain, since we will leap from 1932 to 1940.
If I faint, you might bring up the house at the Casimiro Resort. That's where Lean is. Yes, now.
Beginning in no particular order, I saw Lord Callaghan.
Yes.
At a dinner for Pierre Trudeau.
Yes.
Who said that he had a vivid memory of you in a polling booth in Moscow in 1945.
It's a joke. It's a joke which he's always made to me. Constant joke. That's the joke. He's always said he saw me voting for some kind of Soviet in the Soviet election in 1945, presumably for accepted candidates.
Yes, for Comrade Stalin himself.
It's true, there was an election when Callaghan came as a young Labour MP to Moscow. And I think I met him in the embassy or somewhere for some kind of... He's always told me, I remember you were very well in that polling booth. You were voting? Oh, I saw you voting. I knew what you were doing then. I knew. You never quite admitted to it, did you?
Yes.
How long were you in the party?
That kind of stuff.
Yes, that's all right. Just teasing.
Yes. Do you have any memory of the scene yourself?
None. Of what, a polling booth?
Yes.
Never saw one. Yeah. I never saw one.
Yes. And you have no memory of Callaghan in Moscow in 45?
Yes, I do. Yes, you came as a young Labour politician trying to make his way.
Yes.
He didn't have a job in the government.
Yes.
Then he was doing the Labour government. But I didn't think he had a job then.
Would somebody like Healy have been in that delegation as well? No,
he came by himself. There was no delegation. He came alone, I think. He was the kind of one-man delegation who would knock Haydn just to look around. He was let in. Haydn, maybe there were others. I've got a very faint memory of meeting this young man in some embassy party. In between October and November 1945, whenever the election. The election must have been roughly the time, probably the anniversary of the revolution or some sort of date. No, I didn't know who he was. When I met him again, I didn't realize I'd ever seen him before.
Yes.
You can ignore that.
Okay.
So you go right to Keller and say, I became purple in the face when you asked me what I was doing.
Another Labour figure who crops up, I think, in wartime Washington is the young Jack Jones.
No, I never met him.
Never.
I'll tell you, when some people cropped up in Washington, they all cropped up sooner or later. Roy Jenkins' father was a man called, he was actually PPS. I was supposed to know about America and American politics and all that, and how to meet people, how to approach them. I was sort of it's called the Occidental expert. You know, Cairo's always Oriental secretary. I was the Occidental secretary.
Right.
And so they used to come and see me in case I had anything to say to them. He was a fuzzy-haired man. He had been a miner. He was a Labour politician. You know,
Roy Jenkins' father?
Yes.
Oh, really?
Roy Jenkins was a miner, but soon became a politician, a Labour Party politician. Obviously, we've seen both of our able and so on. And by this time, as I say, PPS, who actually was the Prime Minister. No, he wasn't Prime Minister. He was Deputy Prime Minister during the war, but he even was his Parliamentary Prime Secretary. And he came to see John L. Lewis, because all these Welsh MPs always thought that if they saw Lewis, they could do something with him. Because he was Welsh, and he was a miner, and Lewis was violent anti-British, and played with the Communists at that period. No, he was always very nice to them, extremely hospitable and kind and good, but he did not the faintest difference. He knew exactly why they came.
Yeah.
He wasn't going to yield with all that. He loathed the English remains to the end. They regarded public enemy number one because he organized strikes in the middle of the war. So very unpatriotic. He did it. You know, you have other people said, "Monsieur, there was a delegation of conservative then Labour who came to look at American factories. They did some kind of industrial delegation. Michael Isaacs, who later became Minister of Labour under Attlee. Ooh, this sun is so cruel," he'd say. "Ooh, it's cruel."
What is middle cruel?
Of summer, the sun.
The sun is so cruel.
Cruel. Oh, it's so cruel. You see, he came, very people came. Then the person I got on with was a minor leader of the period, head of the miners' union.
Who was?
I can't remember. Talked at length about what it's like being a miner. Can't remember.
Is this your first contact with the organized working class in
no.
Great Britain?
No. Great Britain, yes, but not America. I've told you my story.
You've already, yes.
Yes, no, Great Britain, yes. Yeah. Certainly. I always got on quite well. It's quite good. They didn't attack me. What was his name? Lowther.
Lowther?
Will Lowther.
Will
Lowther. L-A-W-T-H-E-R.
And you liked him particularly?
I liked him very much.
Why?
Nice, good conservative man. Whoa! And I was a Czech wayman. What's a Czech wayman? Tell me what a Czech wayman was.
Yeah.
I was doing this the other. But I mean, the union wasn't well organized then. I don't know, it was an old cook, A.B. Cook. He was kind of communist, really. He wasn't as good. He organized general strike. Didn't do as much good. A lot of this went.
Yeah, right.
We went away history.
Right.
But I met other Labour members.
Let me move you to, you'll see just how random and appalling this is.
Random as we can be.
This is like all
be
the
random,
things
be
that
random.
Been trolled from...
Be nothing better than randomness.
Okay. Complete randomness. Now we're going to talk about... What does the name Michael Corley still say to you?
I was a great friend. He was a great friend. I lived in rooms. After, I must have met him in about 1930. There were three Mulburians, Kim Mulgrew, not the generation after Blunt, McNeice, Betjeman.
Yeah.
Which was one generation. The next generation had a man called Bernard Spencer,
yeah.
who was an East Seat and a poet at Corpus,
yeah.
Whom I was friends. I think I talked to him about him.
He'd gone to Mulgrew.
He had been in Mulgrew, yes. And his friends in Oxford were two other Mulburians. One was a man called Coppleston, who I think died very recently, who became a civil servant. Looked up the universities from the ministry, looked up the treasury, I don't know whatever it was. And the other was a man called Michael Corley, who was a scholar of Oriel, and Helen was called Balian. And they were friends of my friend Spencer, so we all made friends together.
Yes.
And we lived in a room, we lived in lodgings together in the year 1931, 32.
Right.
We shared
our
house.
Where?
It was called St. John Street, but I think it was in Wellington, no, it's called Wellington Square, but it wasn't John Street, corner of St. John Street and Wellington Square.
Yes.
Landlady and all that.
Perfectly
right. Normal house and so on. And they were great friends, and I'm very well with them. Coppleston sent down from Balliol for writing improper letters about a very famous don called Urquhart, who was a great, terrific figure at Balliol, for accusing him of homosexual tastes, which was quite just, but not allowed to be said. So he was removed for two terms, allowed to come back. Rather grim character, but remained a friend of mine. I lost touch with all these people. Bernard Spencer was killed, falling out of a train. Between Vienna and somewhere, Innsbruck. He was in British Council. Whether he threw himself out or fell out was never known. Michael Corley became a barrister. He used to eat dinners with me. At a time when I didn't know what to do, I had some dinners in Middle Temple, which you know is a preliminary, doing the bar examination. I never opened a law book, I never did anything, but just in order not to waste time, my last year, I used to go after, and he wanted to be a barrister too. So we travelled together.
Yes.
But I was very fond of him. He was another dwarf, tiny little man.
Yes.
And knew him and his sister.
Phyllis.
But I never know what happened. Kirby. She married Bernard Smith's brother,
yes,
who called himself Spencer Barnard. Changed his name. But I never knew what happened to him at all, Corby. I mean, I've not seen, he may or may not be alive. I've totally lost touch with him 40 years ago.
Yeah.
Why do you ask?
Because there are a lot of letters from him.
There are.
A. B. Stephen Spender remembers you and Corley together in Salzburg in 30 or 31.
Could be.
Do you have any memories of going to Salzburg with Corley?
No, now that you say it, he must have done.
Yeah.
So you ask me whether I remember you, no, no.
Yes.
I must have gone with him. He must have come with me to Salzburg about it. Quite
Stephen
right.
Remembers it as being a case of Corley being rather your page, I mean, in attendant upon you.
Well, he was very fond. We were friends. I don't think he was interested. No. No, I think that's false. He was a perfectly independent character. He did philosophy, he did rates, and he probably got a second. And he just happened to lodge with me. I mean, we were on very good terms.
Yes.
And we must have gone to Salzburg in 32, I think.
Yes.
Maybe the summer of 31. Perfectly possible.
Yes.
But I have no recollection.
I
have no memory of that.
Yes.
I'm sure it could easily have happened.
Yes. I get an impression from one letter that I found in your files that Corley was bitterly disappointed that he didn't get a first. And
could
you
well
did.
Be.
And
well
it's
be.
At that point that your paths suddenly diverge.
No.
You go to New College
no.
and then very quickly to All Souls, and he feels, I think, left behind.
Could be, and then he became embarrassed, I suppose. And he married a waitress.
Did he?
Yes, that he did.
Uh-huh.
I was told that. I think I ever met her.
Yes.
In later life.
Yes.
I think I used to ask about him, Bernard Spencer or Coppertone, one of these people, who I think kept in touch with him.
Yes.
I'm not sure. I had some guilt. I did see him after that. We didn't part in 32.
No, there's a letter of seeing him in Salzburg in 38.
As late as that?
Yes.
No, you can't, that's not right. 38 is Anschluss. I didn't go to Salzburg.
37, yeah.
37 is possible.
What guilt might you feel about it?
About not having kept up with him properly. Great friend, and then we drifted apart. I didn't really want to see him very much. When we met, we were very perfectly nice to each other. But I felt the friendship thought we kept up.
Yeah.
And this one wasn't. And I thought, must I do something rather artificial if I tried to. He was then 37. That surprises me. If you say that, all right.
I wouldn't go to the stake for the date. It's just 3 or 4 years after 32. That's
quite.
All I'm saying.
Well, he might well have been there. Not with me. He must have cropped up. If so, I saw him, of course. We never quarreled. There was never any estrangement of a formal kind.
You just drifted apart?
We drifted apart. He lived in London, I lived in Oxford. I mean, we didn't take trouble about seeing each other.
And there was a period, say, 30, 31,
but who remembers him? Who remembers him at that late date?
Nobody remembers him at that late date. There's a reference in a letter.
Of somebody else?
Very taciturn, very Corley is in a bad mood.
He was rather. He was not very well met. He was a self-absorbed, small, rather pretty sort of boy, appearance, and rather undersized, very clever, very sharp, very sort of a certain amount of wit, certain amount of give. He was what should I describe him to? He was ironical, amusing, self-absorbed character. I knew him, I knew his father, I knew his mother, I knew his sister. When I knew him well.
Yes. Well, that's why I'm going over it, because there are letters. There's one letter from his mother to you, there's a couple of letters from Phyllis Corley to you. There's
could well
a
be.
Bunch of letters from my...
Yes. Phyllis was here, I mean, she was an undergraduate. I wouldn't have remembered the name. Couldn't tell you. M.E.F. Corley.
Exactly.
That's his initials.
Okay.
He was quite a certain amount of money. He belonged to a family called Early, which was a family in Hensham, which produced blankets. That's where the money came from. they were called early, they were called, it's a late bird that catches the early worm, was the advertisement. They were quite a rich family of blanket manufacturers. And his father married one. Father, he was Indian, so was that. It's entirely my Marlborough connection. I knew other people in Marlborough too, because friends of my friends.
Who?
Now, a man who died, a man called Carol Jones. Cyril was his real name, but he insisted on being called Carol. Kind of East Seat from Marlborough, a rather silly man. But he was a friend of Spencer's, so I knew him.
And well, speaking of East Seats, did you coincide at all with Harold Acton?
No. No, in here.
Before your time.
You're long gone. Harold Acton was about 23, 24, something. No, he was gone.
I think I meant the memory of him. Was there any kind of...
Oh, yes, there was. He used to come talk, certainly. He used to come to Oxford. I remember him sitting at the English club to which I belonged, at a meeting at which he recited Sea and Sardinia by Dear Schloffens, in a very, very sort of oily, buttery voice, very slowly. And then sun rose and its rays passed through my skin and then through the warmth of my body. You can imagine Dirich Lawrence on physical sensations. You see? And he read it in a kind of loving, rightfully sort of smooth, flowing, sort of rich, buttery way. That's what you like. I mean, it was a conscious easy wave like that. It wasn't someone who just met like that. I met him in later life.
What impression did you make?
Well, I mean, exactly what you think. He was very polite. He was rather boring. He was the original East Seat. He was very courtly. A man of the elaborate, rather snobbish, but amiable and polite. I used to meet him at lunch in London. People were hearing some hostesses. Occasionally invited him to meals, but I was never a friend.
And did you feel your kind of generation, 5 years, 6 years later at Oxford, was rather in reaction against that kind of asceticism?
No, it wasn't. No, I can tell you all about that. I've got a piece to tell you about that, if I haven't already. You see, broadly speaking, when I came up at the end of the golden age of the, that was Acton, Connolly, Evelyn Waugh, who was rather second order East Seat. He never admitted to a top society.
Yes.
He was just a little drunk, it's not me. But still he was an East Seat. And somebody called Howard, what was his first name? Brian Howard. That's all Etonians around 24 and about. Who else belonged to it? Oh, goodness. Anyway, well, Maurice Barrow was our patron. He was a little older. We knew them all. What wrong with them? They were all homosexual. And in those days, as I think I told somebody in an interview, perfectly heterosexual boys who came from ordinary public schools had to pretend to be homosexual in order to get into this refined and very desirable society. And some of them became it.
It was fashionable for me.
No. Now that lot was gone. I came up towards the end of the Silver Age. There were still homosexual issues about. Roy McNeice was not homosexual. Stephen Spender was, but wasn't an issue, in full sense. Well, there was like a Robin McDowell.
Why would Spender be an
estate
at the beginning
no.
of full sense?
Never.
What does estate in the full sense
You wore mean? Special clothes. You had elaborate manners. If you, I'll give you an example. When, by the time I came up, I met a man called François Capel. His real name was Frank Curtis. His father was a colonel in the Malta. I said to him, what college are you at? My dear, I simply can't remember. That was, you see, that was being an East Seat. He wore a dinner jacket, waistcoat, with an ordinary suit. To give a slightly odd air. His college was BNC, in fact, but he called it BNK. BNK because it's called BNC. That's what an East Seat was.
Yes.
He painted a picture called Poissons solubles.
Poissons
sur? Poissons solubles. Soluble fish.
Yes.
Which people know. And then they read the thing called Transition, which is a journal produced in Paris. A man called Eugene Jonas, who was an American exit, for which Joyce wrote. And that was a very, very highbrow sort of surrealist journal.
Yes.
Which means they read Joyce and so on. But they, by the time I came up, there weren't any very prominent ones. They were homosexual, and there was a man called Queen of Peru. He was a Peruvian, called an Ivanetskis or something, who gave nightly parties in loud Grand King Edward Street. The proctors used to raid them, but the noise was so terrible, and so on, and occasionally arrested people for indecency. And he went down to soon. He was called the Queen of Peru, and then there was...
This was active homosexuality as opposed to simply fostering homosexuality?
Both.
Yeah.
Both. And there was a thing called the Oxford Outlook, for which I became the editor.
Yes.
And I became the editor on condition I didn't have to meet the contributors, and as I wanted to, because some of them were that.
Yeah.
And
that is to say, it had a reputation as an aesthetes journal, the Oxford Outlook.
No, it didn't. Highbrow journal.
Highbrow.
But not aesthetes.
But not aesthetes.
No, more aesthetes journal was something called, there was another journal in a competition with it. So I think it was rather more than like that. Name. You know, it had nothing to do with it. And Bernard Spencer was heterosexual. That was an exception. Although he got on with it. And he wore long whiskers in a leopard manner, which I thought through and made friends with him. He was all right with me. But there were, you see, there's a book called Oxford and Margaret by a French writer called Fayard, son of the publisher, Fayard. Oxford, hey, Margaret. That describes, he said, it's in the middle 20s. There were two lots of people. There were aesthetes and there were hearties. The hearties wore huge wooden sort of scarves and enormous buckles and rode and went about in groups and drank beer. Aesthetes went about by themselves and wore elaborately expensive clothes and a very elaborate pansy manners. And when the hearties met aesthetes, they tended to want to beat them up. I've wrote about all that. Somewhere, some of the men, and other men have denied it. After that, and argue about that in some Oxford magazine. And then the aesthetes used to detach chains from lavatories, which they wound around their arm, which then was a weapon. If you unwound it, the knob held off other people. If you swung it round, could hold off the hearties. It's a very favorite defensive weapon of the aesthetes.
Yes.
It's a very different university.
Yes.
Than that. Many you ever know. And by the time I came up, it was already ebbing.
Yes.
And that went on until 1929, when the financial crisis, 31. It killed it stone dead. The point of the aesthetes was, you had to have 4 hours a year in order to be an aesthete, because we knew you'd be sent down. We knew you wouldn't get a degree here, or something would go wrong.
Yes.
So you want an afterlife. You wanted to become notorious.
Yes.
But you have to have some kind of income. But after 31, the parents could no longer pay for the clothes, no longer give you the private income. So then everything suddenly sharply, I mean rather catastrophically, summer of 31, and communists came up. And they gave a lot more trouble to the dons of aesthetes. The aesthetes were not sent down from doing no work and getting drunk and misbehaving, homosexuality. Whereas the communists asked the questions in their essays. That is much more troublesome. That's about when Christopher Hill came. You see? 31, 32. So the whole thing of literary societies died overnight. It was succeeded by political societies. And that was quite sudden. And I remember both these periods. My last year as a graduate was politicized.
By whom? By Sheila Lind, among other people?
No.
That's like
Sheila Lind wasn't here in my day. She was the one. She was in London. I don't know if she was ever at Oxford. She wasn't gone down. That's it, that wasn't the name. No, 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 she wasn't an active politician. She just joined the Communist Party in a quiet way. No, it was done by sort of active undergraduates in the colleges who took over the Labour Club. It had been Socialist Club and became Communist Club. And not many towns did anything to it. I never knew of a single Oxford Don who was actually a member of the party. There may have been, but he's still not known to me. Except Christopher Hill, who never knew to be a member of the party, except me. I was naive. I knew he left wing, I knew he went to Russia every year. Not that he was a member of the party, it didn't occur.
He also sent you Plekhanov from Moscow, and he sent you Mega from Moscow.
He sent me Mayakovsky too,
yes.
One of his poems. We were in very good terms then. Did he send me Mega?
You made inquiries about Mega when it started publishing in Germany.
I know, but I think I bought it in London. I think I got it from some Soviet bookshop.
Yeah.
Oh, he might have done, yes. Anyway, he sent me, we were in quite good terms then.
But not subsequently?
Well, we quarreled, in effect. No, we were in perfectly good terms until 1948. After when he wrote a book called Lenin and the Russian Revolution. It was written in a series headed by Rouse. And I read it. A friend of his. I read it and I'm shocked. It said, well, this, I mean, it's really very amended. It said things which he must have known not to be true. I realized then that he was a member of the party and he had to do it. But comparatively, it was not entirely faithful. It said, for example, that said nothing about Trotsky. Mentioned him once, named Trotsky. The Russian Revolution was physically made by Trotsky. He was the man who seized the telephone exchange, the police station. I mean, carried out the actual putsch, the takeover. And nothing, hard evidence. He didn't say that Trotsky took £500 a day from the Allies, which was the official Soviet version. That he was a traitor and paid by the English and the French to be a traitor. That was the official line. He didn't say that. To that extent, he deviated. He also said that the Constituent Assembly, of course, through the Bolsheviks, and you got a very small number of votes in that, but the socialist revolutionaries got quite a lot of votes, particularly the left-wing ones. That's why they had to have a coalition in 1917. He said, well, because peasants voted for socialism, but they really meant to vote for the Bolsheviks. They weren't clear about what they were doing, but Lenin was quite right. He knew the peasants. He was supposed to be in touch with things in Russia. He knew what they meant was him and his friends, even though they happened to put ballots in the wrong boxes. You see, I thought it was too much. So I told John Sparrow, said to me, who rather liked Chris Vail, with certain homosexual inclinations, said, have you read Chris's book? I said, yes. What did you think of it? I thought it was intellectually dishonest. He went to dine in Bagel, Sparrow, his friend Mr. Brighton, met Chris Vail, a friend of his, and said, Isaiah says, your book is dishonest. I was telephoned to by Christopher at midnight, very near it, and he said, true, did you say? And he told John Sparrow that my book was dishonest. I said, yes, I did. Why did you say that? I said, look, I can't talk to you about the telephone, it's rather silly. Come to lunch with me. Tomorrow I'll tell you. Came, I told him. He said, well, I don't happen to have a high opinion of Trotsky. I don't think it was much good there. I thought the pendulum had swung so much in his direction, there was no harm in giving it a swing in the other direction. It was not a very good answer. As for the Constituent Assembly, said, well, I may have been slightly wrong about that. Well, after that I knew I couldn't, after I realized he put everything on the altar of the party, no good knowing him personally, because he belonged to something else. After that, clearly I was pro-American. He was anti. I tried to persuade him that Americans gave money to Africa not entirely in order to make profit. There was a certain amount of humanitarianism involved. nonsense. After that we met, we talked to each other. When he became a master, Bader, I wrote him letter congratulations, got an extremely warm answer from him, as a real friend, but it did no good. Just for that reason. Because I realized that he was, as Leonard Moore would say, he didn't have a free mind. He was servant of that. But we had big friends, in 37. He was extremely clever, amusing, agreeable man. Ferociously anti-Zionist.
That didn't come between you?
No. Never came between me and any anti-Zionist, who I ever knew or liked.
Since we've come to 47, 48, just because we're there, I wanted to know, because I didn't clear this up last time when we talked about Guy Burgess, when and by whom you were debriefed by MI5.
Oh yes, that was the year in which Blunt was blown, which would have been when Burgess was dead by then. So it would have been, I should think, about 61 or 2. I think I'm right, or 71 or 2. Things I mean, I no longer remember dates. It was whenever it was, not when he was exposed, but when MI5 knew all about it, when he confessed.
Uh-huh.
Although I didn't know it. Then, you see, that was only turned out to be true later. I had no idea. But whenever it was, I remember it was that year.
And was this the Spycatcher interview?
Yes, yes. Spycatcher came to see me. He said I belonged to MI5, and I see what. So, but he had said me.
And that was your first encounter with the intelligence services?
No, it was not. Technically, I have to tell you, my first encounter with intelligence services was Guy Burgess himself.
Yes.
And also this man called Colonel Grand, whom I visited at his request.
In 40.
In 40. You see, which I had nothing to do with him. I mean, I didn't know what he was doing, and I had no contact with him ever. After I never worked for him in any way. It's totally, casually, entirely accidental. That was just cover, used by them for the purpose of getting Burgess, or rather Burgess himself, getting to Moscow. So I had no contact with them in the sense of knowing who they were, or talking to them, or doing things for
and
them.
And when Burgess flew the coup in 51, did you make any contact with MI5 or any?
None. They didn't come see me.
You did not volunteer any information as to the communist past of any of your friends?
No. Nor did I know it was Burgess. I didn't know he was a communist. I only discovered it in 51. I literally didn't know. Remember the party, let alone an agent.
What about Jennifer?
Well,
exactly
I didn't know she was.
Did you know?
I knew her very well.
But you knew that she was?
No. Certainly not. Certainly not. She was a secret member of the party. I never told anyone. Didn't tell me. I had no idea.
That's the one, the Jennifer issue is the one issue where I think your memory is playing you slightly false. Unless I'm misreading a letter.
From her?
She says explicitly to you in a letter.
When?
In 39.
Go on. Ah, then she ceased to be. Then she ceased to be.
That she is a member of the party
she
and
wasn't.
She's thinking of getting out.
She wasn't. By 39 she was not. She met Herbert Hart, with whom we started living. She couldn't marry him because the civil servants and female civil servants were not allowed to marry till the end of the war. Literally not. So she set up
a menage.
She was pretty promiscuous, Jennifer. Is by nature. And she believed in that. She believed, why not pleasure? She was taught that by the man who first went to bed with her, that if you wanted and enjoyed it, have no guilt. Why not? Want to go to bed with people? Why on earth not?
Who taught her that?
A man called Elliot Felkin. I knew in Washington, that he was a charming man, was at King's, kind of Bloomsbury, semi-Bloomsbury figure, who was a League of Nations official.
And a grand séducteur?
He wasn't himself. No. He probably did a bit. No, this is ideological. Came from E.M. Forster, came from Keynes, came from kings pre-war. You see what I mean? You see? But doctrine. And he apparently, I think he's, he knew Abu Ghazal, I think, her father was a colleague of his, or something like that. And I think he was, she told me afterwards, that he was the first person who preached to her about sexual freedom. No, she began living with her, but I was in 38. And I think he talked out of it by then. So in 39, I doubt if she was still a member. She slipped out of it by then. There wasn't any great denunciation. She didn't write them a letter. She was not a comic, she was an agent.
Yes, yes.
Was
sorry,
he?
Yes.
She was an actual agent. She claimed she never did anything for them. After that, I can't guarantee anything. And another government.
But that she's telling you by 39 by letter.
Well, she's
I was an agent and I've stopped. Or I was a secret member, but I've stopped.
I didn't know she actually told me. If she did, she did. But that I've forgotten. I mean, I knew she was at some stage, but I can't tell you when. You say 39? Could be. Could well be. Because Herbert, I mean, paid no attention. Can't preach it. Herbert was then Liberal, not Labour Party. She became, and somehow or other. She was a great friend. She supplied me with a girl who did all the typing by a book on Karl Marx, who came in the civil service.
Right.
That sort of thing. We were on very good terms, always. I met her when she was undergraduate here.
Speaking of women, I wanted to. One of the things I wasn't clear about was when your relationship with Sheila Lind or your friendship with Sigli Lind began.
Sigli Lind. That began in Salzburg in 1931. Summer. I think it's the first year I went. I went with my friend Frank Harley, my tutor at Corpus. We went to Salzburg together, persuaded him to come, and a gentle began worldly dawn. And there I met a man I knew called Felix Markham, who was a don at Harvard, who had been in the Jewish Society with me, was the philosopher and painter of the Game Historian. And his friend was Sheila Lind. And I met her in Salzburg. For the first time. We made friends, and then I saw her afterwards and fell in love with her. But nothing ever happened.
Well, what did happen?
Nothing. Well, we saw each other a great deal. I felt I was in love. We never kissed. We never touched each other. I was very inhibited.
But you went to concerts? You went to...
Oh, yes. And no doubt we had lunch together. She was a great friend.
Yeah.
But I think she would have married me if I'd proposed. She never suggested. Was a good bit to bed. Never. I don't think she did get a bit for people. In fact.
She's a very constant correspondent. I mean, for 15, 20 years.
Oh,
a long time.
Well, I don't know how long it went on for. I knew her parents. I used to go to parties in the house. Robert Lind and Sylvia Lind was a Georgian poetess. With this sigil, with this star, Solomon, King Solomon, sealed the mouth of many a jar. Line by her mother. Anyway, and he said to me, oh yes, I was in love with her. I think she was the first person I was seriously in love with. And I asked myself whether I wanted to marry her, but there was no sexual relation between us. That's because I was obviously terribly inhibited. It had to be allowed. I obviously suffered complexes of some kind. Maybe I thought it was very ugly and wouldn't attack women, whatever it was. I wasn't conscious, but I felt no desire to embrace her or go to bed with her, which I had to check. That was not so. What she felt, I cannot tell. But as a result of being abandoned by me, or indeed, as a result of nothing happening, she went and married a kind of working class communist called Granville, which is not his name, he's a Jew, I think. He lived in a house in Hampstead, Keith Grove, and became a hard-working, faithful member of the party. But lapsed in the end. I met her at a concert in Sadler's Wells. I think it may have been Fidelio or something. And she said to me, this time I'm hungry. And she said to me, I left the party. I can't bear it. I can wait for it. Not long, but very long after she died. She He never married anybody. The time when
were
I met
you ever
her,
as fond of BJ as you were of Sigmund?
Oh, no, no, no. No, no, not in love. One second. No, she was lived in New College with lodgings. She was a lodger of the warden of New College. Some contact with her parents and them, I don't know why. And I used to see her there at meals and things, so I was invited. And then I kept up with her perfectly well. She was a friend. Went to Ireland with us. All that happened. No. She was very, very pretty, like an Irish Colleen. But I felt no physical emotions of any kind. Though I quite see that people might. Her life was ruined by a man called Howard. He was a very handsome, bottom, sort of undergraduate with members of the groups. Father was a man who writes articles in the Times. Father of Philip Howard. He broke her heart. She did it be in love with him. Probably was that he abandoned her.
And then she married, B.J. married Jack Gaster?
Certainly.
Yes.
With still alive.
Right.
Very advancing, quite nice. He's the solicitor of the Communist Party. And always had been. Many years. I knew his father, who was the head of the Sephardi Jews in London. Ha hum. Dr. Moses Gessler. Bearded Cook.
Now.
But the Linters were my friends.
Yes.
So
yes. I'm jumping. How much more of this can you stand?
Any
Are you feeling tortured?
Any of my, no.
Okay.
Continue.
Who is Clarissa?
The man who came to see me, the man who came to see me was the spycatcher man. In about 60, it must have been. I was both homes. And I was not in this room.
Yes.
Therefore, it was before. I was married. There was I still kept another room, that's right. It was before I went to Wolfson. Now, I went to Wolfson in 66, and it was before that. Therefore, it was 62 or 3, then about. That's about when Blunt was blown. He was exposed when? 74, 73.
Yes.
Not quite a long time out.
Yes.
You see? And this man came to see me. He read a long list of names. Do you know any of these? I didn't know any of them. But the one I think I knew, he said, what is he? I think, well, he's writing a very part. Do you know much about him? No. And then he talked about Burgess. Not a word about Blunt. He talked about Burgess and possibly McLean. And I tell him what I knew. They went out of the police, such matters. And that was it. And then he said to them, what about you? Were you not? We were in any way Marxist or drawn towards it. I said, if you'd read my book on Karl Marx, you would have seen. It's not a favorite book of the party. He said, no, matter of fact, you're right. I have read it. You're quite right. Then came to see me again in the Reform Club, which I was then a member, and I think I asked these sort of questions. I told him what I knew, but wasn't much. Do give me one of your things.
Good.
I love them. Full face and haggard. Full face.
Yes.
I had no idea who he was. I knew he came. My brother said that, I believed him. And that was all. You also went to see Jennifer. I wouldn't talk to you. Cindy Packy. It was very bad to announce my old comedy friends. Not the first thing.
On that issue, don't you think that the Burgess McLean affair rather indirect way, colored. Let me ask it as a question. What effect did the Burgess McLean affair have on your politics? Did it
none.
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 You were already the way you were.
And I've always been.
Yeah.
I was never painted on by Mark.
Well, in that, I have to say.
I was quite respectful to it in some ways.
Yes. As an intellectual system.
Yes, and also, I mean, I can see the motives for being anti-capitalist and so on, which had my Plekhanov very much. I read him as a great person. He made a difference to me. Not by Marxism, but by writing about the French philosophy, or the anticipators, Karl Marx. I never would have read about it if I had read him connected to Marx.
It's Plekhanov who takes you back to the 18th century. Did go to certain things by the strangest route. You know, Stuart Hampshire roars with laughter when he remembers you on an Irish bus reading Flaubert's Bubar and Pinochet in Russian. I said no such book can possibly exist.
Bubar and Pinochet. Very difficult. Translated into Russian. My French, it's very difficult French.
Yeah.
To get a book.
Yeah.
We know what the subject is.
Oh.
All the scientific discoveries. They're trying to cultivate themselves.
Yeah.
I was sitting in an Irish bus with Stuart going from something like Limerick to Dean West, South West, from which we took a boat to the Glasgow Islands.
Yes, yes.
That was a journey. Not a rough Irishman in front, roaring with by something, rather drunk.
Yeah.
I thought it